Support for KNKX comes from WSECU, now offering 3 new Visa credit cards and 3 new checking accounts, with benefits that fit a variety of lifestyles and financial needs. More information is available at WSECU.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
My first job in broadcasting came in 1992 in Canton, Ohio, when somebody decided that I should be the guy to read the morning announcements at Glen Oak High School. You know, the announcements. They play over the school's PA system and update the student body on vital news, such as where to buy the raffle tickets or what the cafeteria is serving for dessert. It was like a hyper-hyper-local version of Sound Effect, which is what you're hearing right now on KNKX. So each day, I would tick down the list of announcements and then sign off. I'd say, those are the announcements.
Those are the announcements.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer.
Have a great day.
Have a great day.
Spirit Day updates, water polo scores.
Rally to show your eagle pride. Those are the announcements. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Have a great day.
Now, to an adolescent, aspiring broadcaster, this all felt pretty square. It didn't have much room to, you know, shine. I did theater and liked attention and fancied myself a little bit of a comedian. So I began, very subtly, to spice things up, starting with that sign-off.
Again, Science Olympiad will meet in the gym today. Those are the announcements. Gabriel Spitzer's the name. Have a great day. And farewell to Mr. Reese. Those are the announcements. I'm still Gabriel Spitzer. Have a great day. Thursday during lunch. Those are the announcements. I'm, guess who? Gabriel Spitzer. Have a great day.
Comic genius, right? I could just imagine all the snickers and all the classrooms each morning. What a cut-up that Spitzer is. But it wasn't enough. I wanted real laughs. I wanted to stretch out in the medium and explore my instrument. So one morning, I read through the list of announcements with the debate team schedule changes and the student council election reminders, and then I got to the end. And before I knew it, I signed off like this.
Those are the announcements. I'm John Holmes. Have a great day.
Now, if you don't know who John Holmes is, well, this is a family show and you can go Google it on your own time. Maybe not at work or around kids. Suffice to say, he was an adult film actor renowned for his proportions. But there was no Google in 1992. Either you knew Mr. Holmes' work or you didn't. And as the day wore on, this fascinating divide began to reveal itself. I learned which teachers had never heard of the guy and which ones knew exactly who he was. I got a conspiratorial grin from the drama teacher. An assistant principal was perplexed. My chemistry teacher was incredulous. I started out my morning pretty pleased with myself. But then, over the course of the school day, as I took in all the shocked reactions, it dawned on me that I had done something reckless. I began to feel the blood rising in my cheeks. By the time I was summoned to the office that afternoon, I was ready to tender my resignation even before they asked for it. Which they did. For what it's worth, the vice principal wasn't mad.
You're a bright kid.
More, but resigned.
What do you want me to do here?
That first brush with regulation of the public airwaves left me feeling deflated. I didn't touch a mic again for many years. There was a valuable lesson in this, a decade and a half before the advent of social media. Bad choices made in public are tough to take back, even if you're just a kid. Which brings us to the present. Today on Sound Effect, our theme is Folly of Youth. Stories of the mistakes we make as part of growing up. Those are the announcements. I'm Gabriel Spitzer. Have a great day. In the picture, Herbert Nichols Jr. looks even younger than his 12 years. His hair is parted down the middle. His ears stick out a little, and he has just a hint of a guileless little smile. And around his neck is a placard that says 13973, Herbert Nichols, prison number. Now, we know a kid's behavior has a lot to do with the kind of parenting he got. But back in the 1930s, a child like the one in this mugshot would likely just end up being labeled a bad kid. Federal Way author Nancy Bartley wrote the book on Herbert Nichols Jr., and she shared his story with us.
Herbert Nichols was 12 years old. He weighed 60 pounds. He was malnourished. And he lived with his abusive grandmother in Asotin, Washington, down on the Snake River. And this is 1931. He had run away from home one night, and it was shortly before midnight because he was hungry. He decides to break into the general store to get something to eat. While in the process of filling a sack with candy and gum and cigarettes and various things, he was surprised in the act by Sheriff John Wormell. Herbert had a stolen handgun with him, and he hid behind the vinegar barrel. Wormell walked slowly through the store, shouting for Herbert to come out. And Herbert, being 12 and not necessarily thinking, you know, maturely, figures that if he just jumps up and fires a gun, Wormell is going to run away, and then Herbert's going to go out the back door and run up the hill and hightail it to Canada, where he's going to be a trapper. Well, it didn't quite work that way. He jumped up and he fired, but Wormell was quite close, and the bullet struck Wormell in the head and killed him. The rest was, of course, that Herbert's immediately arrested. He's put into a one-room cell in Asotin, and he is destined for prison.
So let's rewind the tape a little bit and talk about who Herbert is. How did he wind up in that position?
Well, Herbert was from a very poor family. They lived in Star, Idaho. They had 9 kids total, and his father was mentally ill. His mother was incredibly poor. She was trying to support the children, and this was in the middle of the Depression. The father had shot and killed a neighbor woman, and was sent to the state mental institute at Orofino. But afterwards, there was no one left to like hunt or fish or to feed the family, and she had to give away all her children to various foster homes and relatives to see that the children, you know, wouldn't starve. So Herbert went to his paternal grandmother in Asotin. And that's where, you know, he ran into far more trouble than he'd been into before.
How did that play out there?
It did not play out well because she was a religious zealot. She believed he was possessed by the devil, and she could just whip him for any infraction, and she would starve him. And that's why at 12 he was only 60 pounds. When they put him in the one-room cell in Asotin, he was at risk of being hanged, and they had to move him.
You mean like lynched?
Yeah. He was at risk of being lynched by the people who lived in the area because they were so angry. So they had, for safekeeping, they had to move him to Pomeroy.
Wow.
Yeah.
So what happened next, and how did the justice system handle this really unusual case?
Well, first of all, the way the law was set up at the time, there were juvenile facilities. But they were set up for what was called status offenders. And they were people who like ran away from home, kids who may have been abandoned or whatever. And they weren't set up for violent offenders. So Herbert could not go into the juvenile justice system because he was a violent offender. And they had rules that you can't put murderers in with, you know, the juvenile system. And on the other hand, the state penitentiary couldn't quite get used to the idea of someone that young committing a murder. So he was sort of in between. What do you do with very young people who do really awful things and really hurt people? In Herbert's case, the state decided that they were going to put him in the adult penitentiary at Walla Walla, and that's where they went.
So what ultimately was he sentenced to?
He was sentenced to life, but he ended up getting out when he was 21. So he served about 9 years.
So what was Herbert's life like in Walla Walla prison?
He was able to be removed from the majority of the prison population. Eventually, they built him this little shack out underneath one of the guard towers so he could actually live by himself in this little shack. And then he did trustee work, which means the higher level functioning prisoners can go and like work. Like he worked at the warden's mansion quite a bit, and the warden really, Warden McCauley, really mentored him because he was such a, he was a likable kid. He wanted to be loved. He wanted all these things that are normal for children to want. He ate his meals with officers.
Not with the other inmates.
Not with the other inmates. You know, he ate his meals with the trustees. He became a student at the local high school, even though he couldn't leave the prison. The superintendent would come in and give him lessons, you know, say, this is what you have to do this week, you know, and he'd deliver to the prison library, and then the prison librarian would mentor him. And then along with two of kind of the well-educated inmates, one was a literary agent, James Ash, and the other was a doctor who was in trouble there, Peter Miller. He ended up being a very good mentor.
So all the he got in prison all the guidance and mentorship and role models that he never got in his own family.
Exactly, yeah. Eventually, another governor came in. It's Governor Martin. Came in and he took interest and then was able to parole Herbert.
So when he was released, how did it go? How did he integrate back into society?
Okay, well, when Governor Martin decided to release him, Martin got involved and said, let's try this. Let's go on down to Tacoma Boat. And so he got him a job in the accounting department and he thrived. Yeah, he was working with numbers and he had responsibility and he was using his brain because he was very bright. And while there, he got to know people with, I think it was the RAND Corporation, and they put him in touch with people at 20th Century Fox and said, Fox is hiring. And and the next thing you know, he's down in Hollywood. But the most important thing is he stayed crime-free. He married, you know, he became a father. You know, he was a citizen.
Yeah. This feels like a kind of nature versus nurture, natural experiment in some ways. And those were concepts that were actively debated in the middle of the century, right?
Yes, of course. Yeah.
So how did Herbert's life end?
He had been, of course, mingling with celebrities through 20th Century Fox and living a pretty good life. But he was always afraid that his past, you know, would be found out because he'd kept it secret. His wife knew, but his son didn't. And one of his investments that he had entered into with Pat Boone had gone sideways, and someone, you know, who had also invested in like a, it sounded like kind of a pyramid scheme or something, he had filed a civil suit against Pat Boone and other people who had kind of organized this business. And Herbert was just irrationally frightened of the idea that this might go to court, and who he was, his whole life, early life as a 12-year-old in prison was going to be discovered. And he figured that that was the trigger that would send him back to prison. He had had heart issues, and he was in his early 60s, and he basically stopped taking his heart medication. And then one night, you know, he was in pain and his son found him in horrible pain and he'd had a massive heart attack and he died.
And the thinking truly is that he did that on purpose because he was avoiding going to court confronting his past?
Yeah, he was absolutely afraid of going back to prison.
What do you make of an ending like that to this story?
I think it's tragic. It's totally tragic. I think Herbert's story is tragic.
It just seems so, I mean, maybe tragic's the word, or just bitterly ironic that he, against all odds, transcended this horrible beginning that he had and this horrible act he had committed and seemed to have beat it. And then it kind of came back to bite him in the very end and ended his life.
Yeah, in some ways it is. The sad thing was that what carried with him in his heart was the trauma that was never, ever healed. One thing I will tell you that after the book came out, and then I heard from the sheriff's grandson, and he had gone to Vietnam, and he had been a prisoner of war. And with a lot of time to think about a whole lot of things, and he thought about Herbert Nichols while he was in a camp. And he decided that he was going to come, when he got out of being a POW, that he was going to go to Los Angeles, because he found him in Los Angeles, and thought, I'm going to go kill him. So he shows up one day at his door, and he knocks on Herbert's door, and this is like in, you know, the 70s, and knocks on the door and said, I'm John Wormell's grandson. And Herbert went white, but he invited him in. And the two men talked and talked for several hours. You know, and Herbert told him, you know, how terrified he was in prison. And then Herbert ended up driving him to the airport. And they made peace.
Wow.
Yeah.
So looking back on this, what do you think the lessons are for how society handles kids who commit crimes?
The lessons clearly are is that children do not belong in prisons. Children need to be dealt with at a young age, you know, removed from toxic environments and treated as what they are, kids, still malleable, still capable of change, you know, and not by bureaucrats who are going to sit there and make judgments like they did with Herbert, that he would always be a felon, he would always be worthless, he would always be a menace to society. You cannot tell that about a person. You can't. I mean, my own son was 12 years old when I was writing this and when I was researching this. And one day I was over at the museum in Asotin, and I was reading through all these court documents, and they had just left me alone in the museum, and I'm looking through the kind of dusty glass, and my son is outside riding the same streets that Herbert Nichols used to play in, and I'm watching my son on his bike, and he's riding over mounds of dirt and making motor noises and playing, and I'm thinking, he is just a kid. He's just so little. And I thought, I could not imagine him being in the one-room cell next door because he shot someone. You know, I just can't fathom that. It's just cruel and inhuman to think that you could have kids that age and hold them responsible.
Nancy Bartley is a Seattle writer, and her book is called The Boy Who Shot the Sheriff, The Redemption of Herbert Nichols, Jr. Nancy, thanks so much.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
You're listening to Sound Effect on KNKX. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and today we're telling stories about the folly of youth. Back in 2012, Dylan Mayer was 19 years old, and he was a few years into a new passion, scuba diving. He says spending time underwater in Puget Sound is like visiting an alien planet full of strange creatures.
There is a fish down there. I believe it's called the Cabazon. It's a very curious fish. It's a large fish. It's an ugly fish. And it'll come right up to you. It'll nudge you with its nose and its face, and it's very curious what you are.
Dylan grew up in Maple Valley, Washington, outside of the liberal blue bubble of Seattle. He's tall, with a slight build. On the day we meet, he wears a plaid button-down dress shirt and a ball cap, nursing a Red Bull and a smoke. We talk on some logs at Cove 2 on the West Seattle side of Elliott Bay. This little half moon of sand and rocks is where Dylan did something as a teenager that would affect his life long after. On October 31st, 2012, he set out to marry his love of scuba diving with his desire to be self-sufficient and harvest his own food. That gray morning, the goal was to pluck a giant Pacific octopus from its den, wrestle it to the surface, and take it home for dinner. He and a friend headed to the popular dive site at Cove 2.
So we went in and went to one of the first wrecks right off of the shore here at Cove 2 and found it in its den.
It was a male octopus tucked into a rock pile next to a boat wreck.
And, you know, the way to get them out is to basically irritate them into attacking you. I've spoken it from the backside. Eventually, it started reaching out through the main exit, and it came out, rolled over the top of the rocks to where I was, and then we kind of jumped at each other. You're pretty much the bait, and you let it go after you. I just hung on to him.
Dylan and the octopus did hand-to-tentacle combat for 45 minutes on the way to the surface. Now, this is actually how you're supposed to hunt the cephalopod. In Washington State, it's against the law to use anything that could poke a hole in an octopus. The idea is that that could lead to this intelligent animal dying a slow death if a hunter has to abandon the fight. Dylan's Kevlar wetsuit protected him from the octopus's beak, which is kind of like a parrot's. The octopus went for Dylan's regulator, the thing a diver breathes through.
The more you try to grab it back from it, the more it's not going to want to give it to you. So you just kind of pretend like you don't want it, and that's how you get it to drop it. And the key is just to stay calm. Once you panic, you'll drown.
When they finally broke the surface, what people saw was a man beating the crap out of an 80-pound octopus. People on the beach started taking pictures, and they did not look happy. So Dylan and his friend hurried to throw the carcass in the back of his truck and head out. Later, Dylan would butcher the octopus and share it with friends and family. He put a few legs away in the freezer for himself. And then a couple of days later, a visitor came to his house.
A game warden came to my house. She wanted to see the octopus. She says she's never had to show up for a call about an octopus before. She wasn't really sure how to go about it. So I invited her into my house, showed her all the packaged meat, and then I showed her the remains of the octopus, the parts that you don't eat, in a bag outside. And according to her, I did everything right and through the book, and asked her what was going on. And she said, "You don't know?" I said, "What are you talking about? Just Google your name. Be careful. This thing is kind of turned into a big ordeal." That's what I did. I Googled it. Saw a lot of stuff.
Outrage is growing tonight over the killing of a giant Pacific octopus that witnesses say was a female guarding her eggs.
A lot of rumors that had become pretty twisted and not true.
Bob Bailey says what he saw yesterday was appalling.
And I said, "That's a she, and she's probably here to lay eggs." At which point he looked at me and he said, "She was on eggs, and now she's not."
It was clearly a male due to the eighth shortest leg, which they have. I believe it's for breathing. And things start to twist into a different story, a story that even I would be upset if I heard. So there was a lot of threats to me and my family, you know, kidnapping threats. People saying they'd come to my house and, you know, kill me and my family.
The threats were out of control. The threats were absolutely out of control. My name is Laura James, and I'm a filmmaker and environmental advocate here in the Northwest.
Laura James is a mainstay in the dive community at Cove 2. She also spent part of her childhood in Eastern Washington, and like Dylan, she had a close connection to where her food came from.
We lived in an orcharding community and we raised our own meat, and every year we'd raise a couple calves and we'd butcher them, and we got to watch it as kids. Like, you're gonna watch where your meat comes from. And I caught fish when I was growing up, you know, salmon and trout, and that's how we ate. That's where we got our protein.
Laura was troubled by the intensity of the hate raining down on this 19-year-old. Anger from what's normally a pretty peaceful group of adults.
Dive shops were banning him and lifetime bans, and this guy ever comes into our shop, blah, blah, blah. I mean, it was really ugly to be faced with that situation at that age when you have that passion, to realize that maybe it's all going to get cut off and that you're ostracized by the community that you were hoping to be involved with and grow in can be devastating. And when you're young, it can have even more weight. And so I felt for him. I just felt bad for Dylan, in my mind at that point, for the kid at that point. I'm just like, there's got to be more to this story. So I reached out to him to try to just be like, "Hey, not everybody hates you. I'll take you out diving if you want to go on a cleanup with me." I couldn't necessarily go to bat for him with the community until maybe he'd done something that showed that he wasn't an animal, he wasn't a monster.
It's worth repeating something here. Dylan didn't do anything illegal. He was hunting an animal that's on restaurant menus all over the Northwest. Where he messed up was not understanding the culture of Cove 2. Yes, people may fish off the dock or jig for squid at night, but divers here think of the octopuses almost like pets or mascots, not food.
He didn't know kind of A, the community standards, the unspoken community standards, and B, the reverence with which the octopus at Cove 2 are held.
And it's not like they're threatened. A recent survey by the Seattle Aquarium says the octopus population in Puget Sound is stable. Now that's in spite of living in some pretty polluted water. That's something that Dylan saw firsthand after he accepted Laura's invitation to go on a dive with her.
She brought me down in her water and she showed me a lot of things that were going on down there. With a lot of like the starfish and wildlife down there dying. A lot of things that I never really thought twice about or even noticed. And one of the dives we did together, we cleaned up one of the areas. And I mean, we had bags and bags and bags of trash. She showed me to always do what you can to help the environment down there, or else we might not have it anymore.
On that day, even though Dylan was with Laura, he still got harassed.
And the guy had actually walked all the way down the street because he thought he recognized the truck of the octopus killer. And they were like striding up, puffy chest. And I actually got between them. I'm like, don't do it. He's just a kid. And I just remember saying, he's just a kid. Just back off. Just let it go. Walk away. The fact that we'd gotten to a point where other divers will come up and be ready to punch a guy on the street, basically, because they recognized his truck. So it was really, like, not the most comfortable situation.
I wanted to be a search and recovery diver in this area, and I wanted to go through all the, you know, training and classes and be able to help people. But, you know, the dive community has a large influence on all those programs. So after all this happened, I just didn't really feel safe going in alone to any of these programs. Part of me was a little angry.
You can only swim upstream for so long. So I can see how that would deter him. And it's unfortunate because I know how much he liked it. I saw it in his face. I saw his face on our dives. And anytime someone stops diving for that kind of reason is tragic, in my opinion.
After his dive with Laura, Dylan went to Olympia to testify before the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife. He asked the agency to officially make Cove 2 and six other popular dive sites off limits to hunting the giant Pacific octopus. Dylan did not become a search and rescue diver. Today, he is a welder. He says he's happy with the path he's taken, and he says he's fine with the nickname that he will be forever remembered by.
A lot of people refer to me as the octopus guy, and that will probably continue to carry on for a very long time. What was kind of a burden back then isn't so much now.
I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and you're listening to Sound Effect. Our theme today is Folly of Youth. Kalika Furley never really had a conventional childhood to begin with. She comes from one of the few liberal, hippie-type families in an otherwise conservative community in Chehalis. She grew up on a sprawling organic farm 15 miles out of town. And all the way back in third grade, something happened that would change the course of her life. It began when she figured out a trick in math class.
Okay, so third grade is when you learn your times tables. You learn your ones. Those are really easy. Like, you learn your twos. You're doubling it, you know. I rote memorized a lot of them, but I would also kind of try to find my own ways to problem solve on my own. I started to recognize this pattern when it came to doing the sixes, eights, and sevens when I multiplied them by five. Okay, so it's for any number times five. It works for any number all the way up to millions and billions, which I have done on chalkboards more times than I can count. If you take, say, five times 16, typically you don't have that just ready to pull out of your head, and you don't want to sit there and count it out on your fingers. So five times 16, you take 16, divide it by two is eight. You put a zero on the end because it's an even number. The answer is 80. For odd numbers, 5 times 17, you subtract 1, is 16, divided by 2 is 8, and you put a 5 on the end, 85 is the answer. So that's all that the trick really is. Really what you're doing is you're dividing by 2 and timesing by 10, which comes out to the same operation as multiplying by 5. Here's the whole catch of it, right? Is that this whole trick is something really, really, really simple, and it got blown, in my estimation, very much out of proportion. And so I went to my mom and I asked her how old she was when she learned that trick. And she and my dad stayed up at night trying to find an example where my solution didn't work. So they sat and, I mean, I stayed up all night doesn't actually mean they stayed up all night. I went to bed and they probably like messed around with it but the narrative is that they stayed up all night trying to find a solution and they couldn't. And so my mom being the woman that she is and thinking that I am this, you know, special person, decided to go to the high school and talk to a math teacher there. And so she talked to this math teacher named Glenn Hunter. And he was like, well, I've never heard of that before. He did a proof, like an actual proof, which is actually the sticking point in this story that I can't quite grasp because, again, as an adult, I look at that and think that this is so simple that I can't fathom how he ended up thinking this was a new thing of any kind or anything that was interesting. And then I forgot about all of that. It turns out that Mr. Hunter had written up the trick, but he had called it Kalika's Theorem. And he had gotten it published in a teaching magazine. So I got like a certificate, they gave me a copy of it, they took my picture, I like shook the superintendent's hand. So that was cool. And then I don't know what happened next, but somehow that got picked up by multiple media outlets.
A Chehalis, Washington student is receiving national attention for a unique discovery.
And that's where Kalika's method for multiplying numbers comes in.
It went by for 2 years, and I totally forgot about it.
While in the third grade, Kalika discovered an easier way.
I don't even know how many different TV spots I did. I flew out to New York to be on a couple of different shows. The local news programs came into my classroom. I got a letter from Bill Clinton. I was in the National Enquirer. That was another one that was like really stands out in my head. Like they came to my school and they took all these math books and piled them up and I had to like hang my arms over the math books and it just was so absurd. Like I had to stay after school so that the National Enquirer could take pictures of me.
Kalika says math isn't even her favorite subject in school, and when she grows up, she says she hopes to be a politician.
Well, that is really neat.
That is something.
Well, I know a lot of...
And that was dumb. At the time, I thought it was ridiculous.
I didn't do anything real special. Everyone can do it, just they didn't do it.
To put her theory to the ultimate...
Yeah, it was just like this flash in the pan thing. But it didn't, I mean, I was from a small town, so it didn't go away completely. It colored my interactions with my teachers from then on. I mean, by the time I got into like middle school and high school, like when people would read my name on the attendance list, they would be like, oh, are you the math girl? And I'd be like, yes, I am. You know, like first impressions are everything. And I had a first impression with every teacher that was positive no matter what. I think it made it so I was going into academic settings in which there was already an expectation for success that wasn't necessarily there. I mean, my teacher in fifth grade, so if you didn't turn in your homework, you were supposed to get a pink slip. And then if you had a pink slip, you had to go to the library to work on homework during lunch. That's a reasonable thing to do. I absolutely never did my homework. I just didn't. And I never got a pink slip. When it would be time to turn in homework, I would say, I don't have my homework. And she'd be like, well, I'm sure you'll get it done tonight. Fifth grade was like kind of right on the cusp, right? It's right before middle school. It's right on the cusp of learning how to like really have those organizational skills, like really like apply yourself. And I think unfortunately what I learned from that were negative lessons instead of positive lessons. I think that I unfortunately learned that I didn't have to work hard because I could skate by with these other things that were known about me. I remember in grade school, I was told, like, when you get to middle school, then you'll have to work hard. And then when I was in middle school, they're like, when you get to high school, then that will be when you work hard. And you know, it went all the way along, all the way up to my master's, and I still have yet to put myself in an academic position where I have to work really hard at something. And I'm not saying that to say that I am so intelligent that academics are not hard for me. I am saying that what I have done in a lot of ways is I have kind of found myself doing things that come easily to me. I mean, even grad school, I was like, well, I want my master's degree because that seems like a thing I want. Oh, well, this program, I have all the requisites for. I don't have to take the GRE. Well, I guess I'm going to do that. Right, I've found myself in the career that I am in based solely on the fact that I wanted a master's degree and this was an easy master's program to get into. I am a social worker, so as far from math as you can get, which, I mean, I love my life, but it's definitely a different life than had I gone into a more math and science-based realm. I mean, I think back, if I could go back and do everything again, as ridiculous as it sounds, I would love to do like civil engineering specifically with a focus on traffic. I would love to study traffic patterns in a mathematical context. And because I never pushed myself in like the maths and stuff like that, that's not something that I could ever go back, do unless I was able to go back to the beginning of high school and like really apply myself. I also have spent the last 10 years working in behavioral health, specifically with kids. I think that pride should be instilled in kids for their effort rather than their output. So I see you're working on your math, and then the kid looks up and smiles. I see that you're smiling. You must be really proud of yourself. Helping them create internal motivation versus external motivation. And I think I had a lot of external motivation because I did this math thing, right? Where it became more about how people saw my success or my failure and less about how I felt about it or whether or not I was actually genuinely successful or failing. One thing that I think is really, really funny is how mad people are about the new math that is being taught now as part of Common Core. But what I believe with that, and I know it's hard for someone who hasn't learned it, but starting with kindergarten on the way up, what they are teaching kids to do is to see patterns the way that I did. What they are teaching is instead of learning rote memorization of math, which is what we were all taught, they are teaching kids how to actually problem solve. They are teaching kids that deeper level of understanding with problem solving that I wish I had allowed myself to delve into rather than staying at the surface. And so I think something like this is so much more common with kids today because they're taught multiple ways of coming up with the same answer, which adults now think is stupid. But really, if you learn multiple ways of solving any problem, that is applicable to all subjects, that is applicable to all things you will face in your life. And I love that the kids today are being taught that in incremental building blocks, and it's like the foundation of their education versus something that they don't even start to experience until they're in college, which is what I think a lot of us grew up with math like that.
Kalika Furley lives in Seattle. That story was produced by Bethany Denton. You're listening to Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and our show today is all about the folly of youth. Now, we might think of youthful indiscretion as the times when we stray from our parents' wise ways, but sometimes it's a parent leading us to folly. Sylvana Clark is a writer and speaker in Bellingham, and she brings us this story.
When I was 11, my mother had me quite well trained for a certain job, but then she fired me from this job. She fired me because I was not cooperating in her shoplifting escapades. We had this whole system where she would go in a grocery store, and my job was to stand at the far end of the shopping cart, kind of facing her, because that way she could put steaks and expensive items into her purse, and if someone's coming down the aisle, they don't see it because I'm there. Then when her purse was totally full, my two brothers were probably 4 and 6, She would tell them, run out of the store really fast, run out really fast, I'll get you candy, and race. So they were very loud, so they would go, I'm going out the store, I'm out the store, and they would run out, and of course my mother would say, come back here, boys, and she would run out like she's chasing them, and of course her purse is just full of steaks and all sorts of things. She'd put it in the car, and then she'd come back and buy her potatoes or whatever. She was even stealing television sets, mink coats, clothes. I mean, this was big time. And we had our plans of who said what and where we would go. You know, I knew it was wrong, but it was such, when you went to the store, that's just what you did. But what I started doing was when I'm at the end of the shopping cart, I would flap my arms kind of up and down and make weird noises like, oh, blah, 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 blah. And so people would kind of look, and then that would just irritate my mother because she knew I was drawing attention to her. She still kept doing it on her own, but not when we were around because she knew I couldn't be trusted. She was always mean to me. I mean, we didn't have a good relationship. It was always, you're stupid, you're ugly, you know, I don't want you around, I wish you weren't in our family. And so this was one way I kind of had a little control where I thought, okay, if I make some noise, that lady over there by the potatoes might look over and would see my mom putting the steaks in the purse and then call the manager. You know, that's how my 11-year-old mind worked. So I thought if I made noise and flapped my arms, it would get attention. You know, I don't want to say I can justify what she did. She grew up in Germany during World War II. So you had to steal, smuggle, be on the black market in order to survive. There just was no other way. Someone told me they call it the hamster mentality, especially with food. They never had enough food. And so even when we came back to the United States, she still had that feeling of there's not going to be enough food. Like when she would cook, there would be just enough. We never had a leftover in our life. There were no snacks. I mean, why would you need a snack? You had breakfast, lunch, and dinner. Be thankful for that. And sometimes dinner would be boiled potatoes, but, you know, be happy for that. Why do you need vegetables and meat and a dessert? So she never lost that mentality of what can I do to survive. And my dad was an engineer at Boeing. I mean, it's not that we needed the money. We had a middle class life, but it was still ingrained in her, how can I beat the system? So she finally got mad because I would do these little obscure things to get her arrested because that was kind of my goal. So she did, you know, what any mother would do to an 11-year-old. She put me on an airplane and sent me off to live with relatives that I had never met in Germany. When I got on the plane, she gave me this school bag and she said, now there's cigarettes in here and there's a couple books on top. So if anyone asks what's in here, I want you to tell them it's all your school books to do homework. Don't tell them it's cigarettes, because somehow she thought that would be smuggling. But the Germans at that time, they were crazy for American cigarettes. And of course, back then there was no security, no TSA, you just did it. So I had my little bag of my cartons of cigarettes and I got to Germany, flew there by myself. And there were some people and they said, Silvana, Silvana. So I went over there and that was my relatives. And they all spoke German, but they were nice to me. And I thought, you know, my mom really has never been nice to me, and here's some people, and they're smiling, and they patted me on the shoulder, so I was feeling really good. Well, the next morning, my Aunt Hannah, she had me get dressed. She, you know, motioned to put my jacket on, and we got in the car and drove for quite a ways. And she didn't speak any English. Again, I didn't speak German, so it was like being on a first date with a foreign exchange student. You know, we kind of smiled and said things. And we got to an army base, pulled up, and this nice little soldier comes out and he says, good morning, can I help you? And my aunt looks at him and goes, PX, PX, PX. And he said, oh, so you're going to the PX. And he looked at me and he said, so you're going to the PX. I had no idea what a PX was, but everybody was smiling. So I said, yes, PX. We get to the PX and start walking up to the door. And my aunt hands me this wallet with a lot of cash in it and what looks like a shopping list. And she'd drawn pictures of cartons of cigarettes. And it said 3 Pall Mall, 4 Winston, Viceroy, whatever the cigarette brands were. So I still wasn't sure what was going on, but she showed me the list. She gave me the money and I kind of figured I was supposed to buy something. I still didn't know what the PX was. So she took me up really close to the door. And this nice-looking family, you know, mom and dad and two little kids were going through the door, and the mom and dad are showing their ID, and my aunt just kind of shoves me through as they went through. And so I'm inside the PX, and I go, oh, it's like a grocery store. And everybody was speaking English, and I thought, this is nice. So I went up to a clerk, and I said, I need to buy these things here, these cigarettes. And she's, oh, over there, back behind the counter, whatever. So I went back there and I had my little shopping cart and I filled my 12 cartons of cigarettes, went up to the counter, paid the money, and walked out. There was nothing unusual about an 11-year-old buying 12 cartons of cigarettes. So I get outside, my aunt sees the stuff and she's going, Gunscoot, Gunscoot. And she's so happy. And I'm thinking, I made her happy and she's nice. And I start walking to the car. Well, she stops me and goes, no, 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 no. And she pulls me behind the bushes. And so now I'm thinking, what's going on? So she takes off. I had a light blue hat. She took off my light blue hat and she started braiding my hair because it was kind of frizzy and just all over. So she started braiding my hair and she pulled out 2 red pre-tied bows, which she put at the end of my braids. She took off my dark blue jacket and she gave me a green jacket. She took off my black scarf and gave me this pink scarf, and then she put a black beret on my head. Because you see, this was my disguise. I could now go back in the PX and buy 12 more cartons of cigarettes. Because see, I didn't know my aunt was very active in the German black market. And one of the hottest commodities was American cigarettes. So we got home and my aunt gets on the phone and she's just making one call after another, and they only last like 15 seconds, these phone calls. And pretty soon people are knocking on the door and they're coming to pick up their cigarettes. And within 10 minutes, we'd sold all 24 cartons of cigarettes. I'll tell you, still to this day, there are times I'm in a grocery store or a department store and I'm not inclined to steal. But I look around and I think, oh, it would be so easy to just for the fun, even I don't wear perfume, but that bottle of perfume is right there. There's no one looking. I could get that bottle of perfume and walk out the door. Oh, that would be great. So that thrill seeking is still in me. As far as life lessons, I think, yeah, it's just to kind of push the boundaries and see what you can get away with, which I've done all my life and still, you know, I've never been arrested or anything, but to just push the limits a little bit.
Sylvana Clark lives in Bellingham. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad and Jennifer Wing with Bethany Denton. And special thanks this week to Posey Gruner and George Wing. Our executive producer is Aaron Hennessy. If you haven't subscribed to our podcast yet, what are you waiting for? It's great. It's free. You get each episode on Saturday, plus a bonus episode midweek with the backstory to one of our pieces. Get in there and subscribe wherever you get your audio, including your smart speaker. Just say, Play Sound Effect, the podcast. Extra points if you rate and review us, or send your feedback to soundeffect@knkx.org. We're back next week when the theme is Money Talks. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.